Arnold, who I know you've had on the podcast, he read it, probably, because of your connections with people in that world.
That's Mr. Schwarzenegger, if people are wondering which Arnold.
Sorry. Not Hey Arnold. But yeah, so it just started making its way through this world, and I started hearing from people, and, you know, people go out and they try to chase so much media attention, and if something amazing is happening, eventually the media will find out about it, and that's what happened. A reporter at Sports Illustrated heard that the Seahawks were reading it, and then we became friends, and then we started talking, and eventually he wrote a piece about it, and now it's been used by all sorts of other athletes. And obviously, you know, when I sat down to write a book about Stoicism, and then when you published my audiobook on Stoicism, I don't think either of us were thinking the target market for this is NFL coaches and professional athletes. But in retrospect, it makes sort of perfect sense, because the idea of having to manage your emotions, to think rationally and clearly, and to make the best of any given situation and sort of never give up hope is kind of the definition of Stoicism and the definition of what professional athletics are really about at the highest level.
Yeah, no, I agree. And I'll give you another story that you have not heard, which is I was recording a podcast recently for the Tim Ferriss Show, and the guest was Chris Sommer, S-O-M-M-E-R, former national team coach, men's gymnastics, and I asked him about books that he had read recently or was reading that he would recommend, and he had no idea that I knew you, and he started talking about The Obstacle Is the Way.
Oh, man.
So that's another feather in the cap.
It's so crazy to me because, you know, like, you can write a book and look, lots of books sell well of, you know, somewhat dubious quality, right? And so for me, like, as a writer, to know that people who are way more accomplished than me, who have done things that I am aghast at and like so inspired by, that it sort of passes their test. Like, the book could sell zero copies, but if like the 10 people who have reached out to me about it at this sort of level, that they thought it was good, that's like all that matters to me.
Well, I think that it also underscores the observation that Eric Weinstein is a sort of mathematician and investor. He's managing partner at Thiel Capital, works directly under Peter Thiel, who's the first outside investor in Facebook, billionaire several times over, co-founder of PayPal, et cetera. Also Palantir. The point being, he made the point to me once that generalized fame is overrated. In fact, it's undesirable on many, many different levels. But selective fame, if you could say pick your 3,000 people to be known among, can be very, very useful. And, you know, would you rather be recognized by the guy waving the wand in TSA as you walk through, or would you rather be recognized by everyone in the crowd of TED, but no one else, right? And
sure,
they're different objectives. Not one is not necessarily better than the other. It's like if you're going for the former, you need to think very wide and kind of cross demographic, People Magazine, television, extremely popular cable shows, etc. If you're going for the latter, you can be very surgical and very strategic in how you set it up. And for anyone who's wondering how this applies to, say, product launches or businesses, I would encourage you to read two things. The first is 1,000 True Fans by Kevin Kelly, which is an essay online. You can read it for free. And then there is also Small Giants. I always forget if it's Small or Little Giants by Bo Burlingham. About companies that choose to be the best and as opposed to the biggest. But each of these companies is highly focused on a small demographic. And I think when you do a book launch, you can attempt to target in that way, which I think is worth the effort and planning, and identifying maybe the 1,000 true fans or 100 true fans or 10 true fans in highly niche areas where those people are thought leaders, right? In the case of, say, NFL coaches. And then paying attention, like really watching maybe verified accounts on Twitter or whatever it might be for at mentions to see if a seed has been planted somewhere that you can help cultivate, right? In the case of the NFL, for
sure.
Instance. And it's like I've noticed with the podcast, like a handful of NBA players are not, yeah, NBA players are listening to the podcast, and some of them have heard me sort of make jokes in Spanish because I used to live in Argentina. And so like Ginobili from the Spurs, has heard the podcast and he heard the mentime que me gusta, which is this like lie to me because I like it kind of joke in Argentine Spanish. And you just need to be observant and follow those things. But if we're looking at observation learning, why ego? I mean, yes, there are components of examining the ego in Stoicism, for instance, but why did you decide to write about ego? And I think also this is probably among many people listening, they will have mixed feelings about that term, right? They
sure.
will feel like it's not 100% negative nor 100% positive. But why did you decide, or how did you come to end up writing about this?
Well, sure. I mean, look, just I think a very accessible way to answer that, what you were just talking about, the sort of difference between going huge or going smaller and influential and then knowing that you grow from there. I think one of those approaches is probably driven by ego and the other is driven by sort of a colder rationality and a more purpose driven approach. So when I hear someone's like, oh, I want to sell a million copies, you're like, why a million? And it turns out that they just pulled that number out of their ass, or, you know, they heard that their friend sold 500,000 and they want to do twice as much, right? So it's very easy to be motivated by vanity or ego, but it takes discipline and purpose to know, okay, these are the 1,000 true people that matter to me, and that's what's important. And so, I mean, part of it just came out of my experience, you know, working with companies and brands, seeing how often ego makes people act against their own interests, sort of to do destructive, negative or inexplicable things. And so seeing American Apparel collapse, that sort of brought me closer to this idea, you know, seeing, you know, people I looked up to and admired ruin things that they built or ruin relationships that mattered to them. These are me sort of over time experiencing some of the difficulties of ego. When I sat down to write the book, I guess I was thinking, okay, if the obstacle is the way is about external obstacles, which we all face, ego is the enemy is about what I would call our biggest internal obstacle, which is, you know, our ego, the way in which our pride and vanity and self-absorption and delusions and, you know, need for control and greed and all these other things that we know are bad. The way those things prevent us from accomplishing what we want to accomplish or hollowing out what we do accomplish or, you know, making a difficult period in our life even more difficult. I'm not talking about ego in the Freudian sense or, you know, some complicated psychological definition. We know ego when we see it. It's, you know, Bill Walsh, another great football coach, he said it's when your ego gets bigger than your ears, that's the problem, when you can't hear the things around you. Cyril Connolly saying, you know, ego sucks us down like the law of gravity. I think we know how ego has ruined people around us, and we know when we've done egotistical things that have caused problems in our life. It's that I'm talking about, not some general notion of the ego that's the problem, if that makes sense.
If I were trying to then just wrap my head around it, how much of ego, as discussed in the book, is trying to build or conform to an image that you hope others have of you? I mean, it's sort of like an image reputational driven issue.
I think it's a huge part. It's this idea of needing to be what you've always wanted to be, needing to be the number one, the center of attention. I guess it's that sort of like petulant child that needs to get their own way over anything else. Or it's like, I've got to get all the credit. I've got to get all the attention. I need people to know how smart I am. I need to be in control. Not being able to see anything bigger than yourself is probably a decent definition of where ego becomes a real problem. And here's another way to look at it. Creativity and sort of doing great things, I think we both know, requires a real connection to reality, right? Like there's an Epictetus quote where he says, one cannot learn that which they think they already know. So if ego has told you you know everything, all of a sudden it's impossible for you to learn. Or if you think the thing you made is the greatest thing ever done, now all of a sudden you're not able to sense from the audience where the improvements need to come or what changes need to be made or to make sort of realistic assumptions about, you know, your chances of success. These are the way I think ego becomes this kind of haze that prevents us from connecting to the reality that's so important to doing great work. I'm not saying you can't be ambitious or optimistic or, you know, driven by ideals, but it also has to be rooted in reality if you hope to accomplish any of those things.
Let's talk about, because I think the ego, pornography, integrity or lack thereof, they're perhaps most easily illustrated and defined with examples.
Sure.
So let's talk about one from the book, which is Sherman versus Grant. Could you give us some context and explain that story?
Sure. So one of my heroes is William Tecumseh Sherman. He was a general in the Civil War. He sort of has this reputation as being the guy who destroyed the South. And in a sense, he did. He's actually probably the greatest strategic mind to ever wear a United States military uniform. I think, you know, you compare someone like Sherman to a Napoleon. Napoleon is someone who sort of always believed that he was destined for greatness, that he was the greatest thing that ever walked the earth, that he was deserving of being a dictator, right? You compare that to someone like Sherman, who later in his life after the Civil War, you know, was famous for declining the presidency. He was like, if nominated, I will not run. If elected, I will not serve. So he's sort of this opposite of what we think of when it comes to the military. He started very young. He was sort of constantly underestimated. He was sent in all these backwater postings. You know, by the time the Civil War broke out, it was like his career was essentially over and he'd not been successful. Nobody knew who he was. And it was only in the Civil War and this sort of immense trial that he showed himself to be this strategic genius, and he sort of earned his place at the top of the heap. And there's this wonderful quote from one of my favorite biographers. His name is B.H. Liddell Hart. I talk about him a little bit in Ego, but he's this brilliant writer. He's a World War I hero. And he talks about, actually I have it. He's saying there's the difference between the kind of people who are utterly confident about the things they're going to achieve in life and the other people whose image is a slow accumulation based on achievement. And he says, like, the last type, their own success is a constant surprise, and therefore, like, the fruits are more delicious. And then he says, you know, in that is poise and not pose. And so I think we tend to think ego is this braggadocio and boldness and whatever, and we sort of discount the problems that has. And what I like about someone like Sherman is that it was his sense of himself is growing confidence when he decides to do this march to the sea, which was in many ways counter to a lot of military theory at the time. He's abandoning the supply lines. He's not doing that based on ego. He's doing it based on confidence, which he earned. He earned it based on his actual performance, the work that he put in, the knowledge that he built over time. And then the other story I tell in the book related to Sherman and Grant. So at the end of the Civil War, Grant, who's also a hero of mine, Sherman and Grant are basically the two most famous men in America. They're war heroes. They've led armies of millions of men. At the end of the war, Sherman continues to be a soldier. He serves for a few more years, and then he retires basically in what amounts to happiness. And Grant, who did not know politics at all, in fact was a good general because he was so bad at politics, decides to run for president. He's elected in a landslide and then serves two of probably the worst terms in U.S. presidential history. He was surrounded by corruption because he wasn't, you know, sort of good at sussing people out that way. Reconstruction stalls. He's just a bad president. And I say that as someone who admires him. He's a bad president. He leaves the presidency and then he opens a financial brokerage with his son and a partner. That partner turns out to be like the Bernie Madoff of his day. And he loses all his money. He ends up having to essentially put up his war mementos to earn money to pay off the investors, and then he writes his memoirs as he's dying of cancer to leave his family something to live on. And there's this letter from Sherman to someone. Sherman is saying, Grant was this great hero, and yet he pursued these things that he had no skills in, you know, being a president. And then Sherman is saying, like, he tried to make money to impress people who would have given all the money in the world to have won one of Grant's battles. That really hit home to me because I, you know, sort of just gone through this stuff in my life. It's like, wait, he'd done this miraculous thing, but because he couldn't understand how impressive it was and he had this endless need to impress other people, he ended up losing everything to impress people who were already impressed with him. And to me, I think that's such a great example of where ego can take us. It takes us so far past our capabilities and our needs because it's insatiable. And Grant died a painful, sad death at a young age. And I think you have to attribute that ego to part of that.
Well, it brings a couple of things to mind. And then I have a question for you, which relates to the question why, right? So we have the characteristics of their respective careers, one in, I think, retrospect, clearly more desirable than the other. But, you know, what made them different is the question I'm going to come back to. But the I guess there are a few observations. There's one, and I might be getting this quote slightly wrong, but I've heard this said, and I'm going to paraphrase it here, before, which is, we work doing things we don't like to get money we don't need to impress people we don't like.
Yeah.
That's kind of the first one, which I think is related to, you know, the engine that drives that disaster is ego. As discussed earlier, a component of which being caring a lot about what other people think. And then the other is actually pulled from, I just pulled up the PDF of some of my line notes, because for those people who don't have the background, I read a very early manuscript of Ego is the Enemy and went through and really just digested every single line and highlighted things that I found particularly appealing or helpful. And one of them was, and I'm going to probably pronounce this incorrectly, but the performance artist Marina Abramovich, I'm guessing, puts it directly, quote, "If you start believing in your greatness, it is the death of your creativity," end quote. So I think that could be a very much related piece of it, right?
Sure. There's a line in Billions, which Brian Koppelman, who's I think also been on the show, is the creator.
Great show.
And it's at the end of the season, and the guy's just made this sort of disastrous bet, Axe has, and the therapist is asking him why, and he's like, "When people call you Superman long enough, you start to think that you're Superman." And I think with Grant, it is like he just won one of the greatest military victories in history. And this is why ego is so toxic. He just sort of defied all of the odds, literally like changed the course of history with his sheer persistence. And, you know, he didn't listen to the doubters. So like part of doing a great thing is that you are, you know, putting a middle finger up to what everyone else is saying. That works, except for when you're wrong, that's when it leads to disastrous things. So like, I'm sure people were like, you know, like Ulysses, like, "Don't run for president. Like, you're not good at this. Like, it's not going to end well." Or like, "What do you know about Wall Street? Why are you creating a financial firm?" It's when we bulldoze right over those really reasonable questions, because we can't say no to things or we want things too badly. That's where we overreach. We believe in our own greatness, like that quote is saying. That's the death of our connection to the reality, which is what made us good in the first place.
So I was given some advice. I think it was just in the first week or two that the 4-Hour Workweek hit the New York Times bestseller list. 2007, I suppose it must have been. And I was told, you're never as good as they say you are, and you're never as bad as they say you are. And I've repeated that to myself quite a lot in good and bad times, right? And I'm just looking at this marked up PDF again, and you have Demonicus, right? You have a number of quotes, but one is, "Abhor flatterers as you would deceivers, for both if trusted, injure those who trust them."
Yeah, totally.
There's a lot to dig into there, but let's talk about someone who is lionized by many people and perhaps unrightly so. And I should also highlight the point that, and we'll probably get into this, that I think believing you are the greatest and sort of drinking that Kool-Aid, believing your own hype, that doesn't preclude you necessarily from being financially successful. Because I think that many people will say, well, what about this person? What about this other person who has clearly an enormous ego? I mean, they're on television talking about how great they are and how brilliant they are constantly. And what I've noticed, at least, is there's a big difference between financial and career success as subjectively defined by the masses or by any of us. Somebody who has a lot of money and gets seen on TV a lot, for instance, and someone who is even remotely content or pleasant as a human being to themselves and others. And it's been my observation, at least in Silicon Valley, that the people who tend to like bang their chests the most and make the most noise are very rarely the people who, left alone for 10 minutes to sit with themselves, who are happy with what they see or can even sit still at all. I mean, they tend to end up being pretty miserable for the most part, but getting ahead of myself.
Look, I think that's a great point. And that's something I thought about a lot in the book, because people always go like, you know, what about Steve Jobs or what about Kanye West? And I think one of the distinctions you have to make is, just because someone is successful to you, that doesn't mean that they have accomplished what they are trying to accomplish or what's important to them. So, like, you look at someone like Kanye West, clearly a musical genius, clearly one of the greatest rappers to ever live. He's made amazing work. And then when, you know, his last album came out a few months ago, or I think it's sort of in this weird release thing that he's doing, but he's admitting that he's like millions of dollars in debt because like this fashion line that he keeps trying to launch like isn't working. And I would argue that it's probably because his ego is most out of control there, whereas he put in so many hours previously on his music when he was aspiring to do this thing as a kid, that he's so talented that it's able to compensate for this monstrous ego, right? And so I think in some ways, it's like ego is dangerous when you're aspiring to something, no question. But it's when you're successful and you've built this thing and then you're trying to do your next thing, when you're convinced that everything you touch turns to gold, that's where ego is the most destructive. Cause it's like, you're trying to do this other thing. You're already rich, famous, you know, talented. You've done this great work, but ego is there shutting that door in your face. And that's not as visible to the rest of the public in the way that it is, you know, when we see some young kid implode before they've been able to accomplish what they're trying to accomplish.
So let's talk about Howard Hughes for a sec.
Sure.
And what is your opinion of Howard Hughes?
So I think Howard Hughes is a great example of actually what we were just talking about, in the sense that, you know, most people who are egotistical, they try something and they fail, right? And then we never hear from them again. It's sort of, they're edited out by the survivorship bias, right? Like, we don't hear from the people that tried to do something and then never made it onto our radar. Howard Hughes is a great example of someone, because he had millions, ultimately billions of dollars passing his way through the monopoly that his father had created in the oil drilling business. He was able to repeatedly fail and waste ultimately billions of dollars in his own lifetime on these ridiculous. I think you could argue, although he was clearly a genius pilot and a wonderful inventor, he was arguably one of the worst businessmen of the 20th century. I mean, he lost tens of millions of dollars in the stock market, speculating on stocks. He owned RKO Pictures, which had like tens of thousands of employees when he bought it and ended with like a couple hundred. He lost something like $20 million in terrible movies with RKO. The Spruce Goose, which he was so famous for in that movie, Aviator, he built this huge plane out of wood. Like, it's a interesting project, but you don't realize like, hey, that was a $20 million government contract for a plane that was late, that flew one time, and then he stored it in a warehouse for 40 years at $1 million a year, right? Like, you don't realize that Howard Hughes, he did sort of these Elon Musk-esque projects that were inspiring and bold, and they almost never came to anything. And the only reason he was never really held accountable for any of them is the fact that Hughes Tool Company, which was what his father created, which after his father's death, Howard Hughes literally never stepped foot in ever again, was the cushion from which all these preposterously egotistical failures would land upon. And, you know, ultimately at the end of his life, he had some mental illnesses, but they even trace most of his mental illnesses back to plane and car crashes, which he caused by being reckless, right? So I see him as this sort of cautionary figure, and Elon Musk has actually said that he sees Howard Hughes as a cautionary tale. It's someone who was so incredibly talented and had so much potential, but had very little discipline and order and objectivity in his life, and it ultimately ended in a very, very bad place for him. And, you know, when I read a really great book on Howard Hughes called Howard Hughes, His Life and Madness, I read this right around the time, you know, the American Apparel stuff was happening, and it was deeply even uncomfortable for me to read, seeing some of those similarities behind this kind of visionary genius on the one hand, but also their own worst enemy on the other, and watching those two forces battle each other.
So two questions. The first is, let's just say that you sat down with Howard Hughes to provide him with advice, or he actually wanted to solicit advice from you. And let's just also assume that he is open to that advice, right? So maybe he time traveled, hung out with Steve Jobs, and took some LSD. And what advice would you give him? And is there any particular point in time? Or how would you try to correct course?
I don't want to dodge your question, but I would imagine you would relate to what I'm going to say. famous or important or wealthy people will sometimes reach out to authors and, you know, invite them to their house or even pay them for like a consulting session where you sort of, they want your advice on some project they're working on or, and so I found myself in situations like that. You know, you're called to someone's mansion or their penthouse apartment, you get there and this is someone you've admired, you thought had it together, you know, you're a fan of their work or, you know, you're envious of what they've accomplished. And you get there and, you know, they're ranting and I've seen them in, you know, these sort of manic fits. They're ranting and raving about these things. It's like, hey, you know, they're obsessed with what some person on a tiny blog said about them or they're, you know, they're convinced that they have to do this thing or they, you know, they're like, I'm doing this project and I want it to sell 100 million copies. And you're just like, with all your knowledge, you just know that that thing is impossible. Right. And you so often you see it's like, this person has become so successful. You realize that to give this person the truth would be a kamikaze mission. To tell them what you actually felt or thought or what you thought they needed to know would implode any chance of you working together. And so I see ego doing that. And I think you definitely saw that with Howard Hughes. He would be this guy. He'd be waging the corporate takeover of, you know, TWA and then also writing 1,000-word memo about how employees shouldn't look at him in the eye, right? Or that how no one should touch anything without putting a Kleenex between their hand and the doorknob. You know,
I don't know how you got a hold of my prep sheet for guests to my house, but we can talk about that later.
You know what I mean? It's very sad. You're like, this is in some ways hopeless because, like, imagine if Richard Nixon had called you and asked you for advice. You're like, dude, you really backed yourself into a corner here. Like, you shouldn't have done any of this. This is insane. You know, they themselves just a few years, you know, before or after would be able to see that, but they're so caught up in the moment and they're, you know, they were similar to how I was when I was wound way too tight and way overcommitted. They're not able to step back and see what's happening with any measure of realism. And I think that's the kind of thing that happened to someone like Howard Hughes, John DeLorean, who's another hero of people. It's like he ran his own company in the ground and then he thought he could try to save it with a $60 million cocaine deal. It's like, this is not the rational mind thinking. This is ego in full sway, convincing you that you're untouchable, convincing you to do bad, stupid, reckless things.
Let's look at then maybe take a different tack. What do you see as the biggest differences between Elon Musk and Howard Hughes? Because Elon Musk is very good at executing. I've been very fortunate to meet him maybe two or three times briefly, but it seems very highly rational. And I'm gonna give also a bit of a tease for one of the paragraphs that I underlined in Ego's Enemy, which is it begins as follows. And I'm not trying to hand you this as the answer. So feel free. I want to hear other thoughts, but. A young basketball player named Luis Alcindor Jr., who won 3 national championships with John Wooden at UCLA, used one word to describe the style of his famous coach, dispassionate. Okay, so I found Elon to be very dispassionate, but in a confidence-inspiring way. And he also has a meticulous, so I guess I'm kind of answering my own question a little bit, but meticulous attention to detail, which I'm sure Hughes had in some respects. Meticulous attention to detail in the same way that Wooden had. So Wooden, I heard a anecdote about him which went roughly as follows. When he had new recruits to the team, he would sit them down and he would walk them through how to unlace and lace their shoes.
Sure.
And I don't know if you've heard this story.
And
the reason being, he said, if you lace your shoes improperly, you get blisters. Blisters cause shots, missed shots cause games, lost games cause seasons, right? And he just had this meticulous attention to detail, even with the unsexy aspects. But what would you say are the biggest differences otherwise from, say, a Hughes and
sure.
Musk?
Well, related to that, another story that I've heard about Elon Musk, and I think it's in that big biography of him, but I read it in a Business Insider article. But it was when he was starting SpaceX, originally they were thinking they were going to buy these rockets and then build this sort of rocket company, right? And that's what a sort of a dispassionate person would be like. That's the idea. We've got the money. We're jumping into it. Let's go. Let's go. Let's go. And that's that sort of manic mindset of, I'm rich, I'm famous, I'm Elon Musk, I can do whatever I want. But that's not what Elon Musk did. They got quotes on the rockets and they were incredibly expensive. And Elon Musk did a thinking exercise, which comes from Aristotle, called going to first principles. And he sort of cautioned the team. He was like, look, let's actually look at what building a rocket costs. So instead of saying like, hey, this is what these defense companies would charge for a rocket, what does it cost to make a rocket? They did the math and it turned out they could make their own rockets for like 10% of the cost of what they could buy them. And so SpaceX really comes from that very simple thinking exercise. And there's a story about a football coach. I forget who it is, but you know, he calls the team in and it might be Lombardi, and he picks up the football. He's got the team gathered and he goes, this men is a football, right? He's like, these people, they've been playing it their entire lives. And he's like, this is what a football is. That's going to first principles to almost an absurd degree, right? This is how you tie your shoes. And Elon Musk is saying, hey, let's actually do the math on what this company should be and do and what we're going to be making and what it costs. Let's not just take other people's premises for granted. And let's also not make decisions based on our presuppositions and our emotions. And so I think, you know, not knowing Elon Musk and not knowing a ton about him, I would say one of the things that he's at least done thus far, and who knows, he could blow it all up tomorrow, he's been very rational and he does these things step by step. And I think he even looked at someone like John DeLorean and looked at the mistakes that he made and rethought it. And when he launched Tesla, he was learning from that experience rather than needing to make those costly errors himself. So I think that sort of dispassion, that objectivity, that willingness to go to first principles is certainly something that has made him incredibly successful so far.
And I think correct me if I'm wrong, but the bio that has been recommended to me a few times now, which I've not yet read, I'm embarrassed to say, is Elon Musk, Tesla, SpaceX, and the Quest for a Fantastic Future by Ashley Vance.
Yes, that's the one I'm thinking of.
There are a number of points in your writing, across multiple books, where you talk about the importance of not only accepting critical feedback, but soliciting critical feedback, right? I'd like to bring up a term that I mentioned for the first time publicly a few months ago in conversation with Eric Weinstein, which was bigoteer, right? And the basic definition of a bigoteer being someone who seeks to profit in some way from calling other people bigots, whether it be sexist, racist, fill in the blank, right? Whether that's simply getting attention for themselves, driving clicks to a particular article because that's how they're compensated. Could be any number of things, material or otherwise. But the reason I thought having a term like that is important, bigoteer, and we may bounce around a little bit as it relates to this question, but is that there are people who currently would call themselves or are called social justice warriors where there's no real negative consequence for hurling these terms around that can cause a lot of damage, right? And you've written an article separately about, I guess it was, help me out here, Fahrenheit.
Yeah, about protecting people's feelings.
451. And it was about protecting everyone's feelings and the problem with trying to protect everyone's feelings and how that can backfire. And so maybe you could start with one of the common misremembrances of Fahrenheit 451, which is who actually mandates that the books get burned. How did that start?
Sure. Yeah. I mean, so everyone reads Fahrenheit 451 in high school. And I think the takeaway is like, oh, firemen are burning books because like a controlling government is asking them to do that. I read the book again about a year ago and you realize that the captain, he tells him, no, look, we do this because the public doesn't like to be offended. The public doesn't like to be upset. That's why we ban books. It's not a government mandate. It's a mandate from the people for the government to enforce getting rid of ideas that are unpleasant. And so Fahrenheit 451 takes on this new light in that sense. You're realizing that it's the desire not to offend that drives most censorship. Most censorship is not controlling. It's well-meaning. And I think it all stems from this idea that someone, my wife says this, I'll be like, you're frustrating me. And she's like, someone can't frustrate you. Like, you can be frustrated, but no one has the power over you to frustrate you. That's something you have. And that's a very Stoic idea. Epictetus, he says, if someone succeeds in provoking you, the problem is you, not them. He says, your mind is complicit in the provocation. And I think that's what we have trouble accepting. So it's not the person, you know, it's like, hey, that's offensive to those other people. Don't say that. It's not those people standing up and saying, I'm offended. It's us trying to be this sort of thought police protecting all these other people. And so I think what we've seen, at least media wise, especially, when we're in this environment that's so driven by clicks and traffic, is people see someone else do something that could be interpreted as offensive. So they interpret it as offensive and they write about it and then they rile other people up. So like, you know, Curt Schilling is a professional baseball player, just got fired by ESPN like 2 days ago for posting some dumb thing on Facebook that I totally disagree with and is totally offensive and close-minded. But it's like, he did not say it on television. He said it on his private Facebook page, which he should probably be allowed to do. And also, you know, we live in a world of ISIS and Donald Trump and all these other things. Is this really the target that you want to go after? And so I think what we're seeing, Ray Bradbury said, there's more than one way to burn a book. It's not just this overt censorship. It's this idea that we need to protect everyone's feelings, be hypersensitive all the time, be pressing the, you know, the outrage button constantly. It exhausts people and it makes it, I think, ironically, very hard to deal with some actually alarming or offensive or dangerous ideas out there in the world or, you know, currently running for president or what have you.
No, I agree. And this conversation, just so people don't think we've gone off the reservation into sort of political speak, these are closely related to the individual self-regulation or conditioning using Stoicism, for instance, right? I mean, just a macro example, but the macro is just a conglomeration of the micro, right? And I mean, one of my most popular, most retweeted, liked tweets in the last 2 years was, if you're offended easily, you're a bad resource allocator. It's a waste of energy and attention, which is a greater sin than wasting time. And so if you're trying to be a good resource allocator, right, and you recognize that your mind is complicit in the provocation if you allow yourself to get upset unnecessarily, excessively. Well, two things I would say. The first is that my greatest fear, I was speaking it to a group of students at UCLA a few months ago, and they wanted to talk about artificial intelligence and the dangers and the promises of artificial intelligence, the threats of, say, whether it be ISIS or other types of existential threats towards humankind, right? Mm-hmm. And how I would kind of rank order them and so on, which I have no credibility for answering, but I do spend a lot of time around people in Silicon Valley and technologists who do have a good read on these things. And I said, my biggest concern for the US specifically is the existential death of free speech driven by, among other people, college students who are going on witch hunts.
Sure.
With this very Fahrenheit 451 type mentality where like anyone who causes discomfort, anyone who offends, anyone who, God forbid, questions the accusations of, you know, racist, sexist, fill in the blank, or asks us at least how we are defining these terms, should be, you know, lynched from a career standpoint at the very least. And that is my biggest fear, is that we're slowly going to kind of choke the life out of free speech and First Amendment in the United States with this like death of paper cuts, where it's not against the law to speak your mind, but it might as well be, because the public has become so trigger shy and aversive to honest conversation that is the knee-jerk response.
I think it's like, you know, if someone told you that saying something was illegal, you'd probably still say it, just like you speed or, you know, you break other tiny laws. But it's like, if someone told you like, hey, if you talk about this subject, everyone on the internet's going to hate you and boycott your things and, you know, get your clients to fire you and pull your advertisers away, you're like, well, I'm probably not going to say that. I think Scott Adams, he had a great thing because he's always getting in trouble. He was saying it's like being creative.
The creator of Dilbert for those people who don't recognize it. Yeah.
He's saying that, you know, being creative is like drilling for oil. Sometimes you miss, sometimes you find it. And he's like, sometimes it catches on fire, you know, and we have to be willing for that to happen. And if we're not, if we don't understand that, hey, sometimes smart people say dumb things, you know, sometimes it's much more complicated than the 2-minute soundbite, you know, 500-word blog post that you read. Sometimes people are deliberately misleading you. I remember all these people that were super mad at, you know, remember a few years ago, Cheryl Sherrod, who was an African-American woman who'd supposedly been caught saying something racist, and Breitbart posted a video, and then she was fired, like, personally by the president. And then it turned out that the video had been, you know, misleadingly edited. Or Whole Foods just got in trouble last week here in Austin because someone accused them of writing a gay slur on a cake for a gay wedding. And then the security footage so far has revealed that it wasn't on the cake when it left the store, and that this guy might be trying to shake them down for money. And so getting pissed off immediately before you all know all the facts is bad. Not being able to understand nuance is bad. You know, I've heard my parents say dumb things. I've heard my grandparents say anachronistic, offensive things. You know, that's just, that's part of life. And if you get provoked, you're not helping the situation. You're probably making it worse.
Well, let me make a plea to the audience. That is, number one, have the uncomfortable conversations. If you get unfairly accused of fill-in-the-blank-ist, don't respond with, I am not fill-in-the-blank, right? Respond with, that seems really outrageous to me. How are you defining X? Force them to define it, and you will find out very quickly, 9 times out of 10, they cannot do a good job, or they just end up making themselves look ridiculous. So don't fight someone or debate someone before you make them fight themselves and debate themselves, because they'll very often just punch themselves out. So that'd be number one. And number two is don't, and I was given this advice actually by, I'm not going to name names here, but a very high level kind of political advisor. I was having dinner with at one point. We had some wine. I was talking about various initiatives and so on that I wanted to undertake, including supporting research related to psilocybin at Johns Hopkins and trying to change the legal status and blah, 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 blah. There are quite a few things. And he said, well, that's a big, long list. He said, you should assume you have one gun, has 6 bullets. You get 6 bullets a year. It's like you have to aim at the right targets. Any more than that, and you make people kind of deaf, dumb, and blind to your pleas and to your messages if you're constantly hitting people. And you should feel that way yourself. But like, by complaining or being offended easily, number one, you're wasting your own resources and making your life worse, not better. Number two, for the real things that matter, you have, let's just say, 6 bullets a year. So like, save the ammo for the right targets. But I'm going to get off my soapbox here, and I want to ask you, Ryan, what do you do in terms of practices, routines to instill in yourself the characteristics that you would like to have as it relates to stoicism or ego? Like, how does someone improve themselves, in other words? But I want to hear your personal approach.
I think journaling is important. So every morning when I wake up, I write in a Moleskine. I do about 2 pages, and I write not just what happened the last day, sort of how I feel about it, and what I'm working on. I feel like if you don't know what you're like, you know, I want to be less sensitive, or I want to be more empathetic, or, you know, I want to stop losing my temper. You know, you sort of write these things down. You're having to articulate your goal. It's not just this sort of vague notion. 2 things that are really important in my diary. So one, I write the amount of time that I spent exercising the day before, which keeps me accountable. And I find that I do a lot of sort of work on myself. I feel that flow state is very meditative. I do a little bit of meditating, but I really feel like I do distance running. And so I feel like my distance running is my form of meditation. But the other thing I started writing down, and this is after I read Cal Newport's book on deep work, I record how many hours I spent in deep work the previous day. And one of the things that helps keep me accountable with some of my, you know, my problems getting distracted and overwhelmed is if that tally isn't 3 or 4 hours, like I didn't spend 3 or 4 hours really working on like my actual creative important projects, then I know I overcommitted to phone calls, meetings, you know, running errands. I'm not managing my life really well. And so writing these things down has helped me keep me really accountable. The other thing is actually writing and talking about these ideas. Like, ironically, you know, you write a book about stoicism, then you write a book about ego. It's very, people are going to not be very forgiving with me if I complain about stuff or I blame other people for my problems, or if I even have to think as I'm marketing this book, like, you know, if I say something that sounds very egotistical, like, somebody's going to call me out about it on Twitter. Like, I think being somewhat public with what you care about and what you're working on is two other ways, I think, to attack some of these things.
Well, doing anything with social accountability, right? I mean,
sure.
You can have you have to have consequences, or I should say incentives, right? Like, economics is the study of incentives. I mean,
sure.
In its simplest form. And personally, I can also say, like, the 4-hour body or the 4-hour work week, right? I mean, blessings and a curse. But it's like, if I'm in a coffee shop on a laptop for more than like 3 minutes, somebody's going to walk by, take a photo of me, make a fucking 4-hour joke, and like put it on the internet. Right? So it's like,
yeah, or if you got in horrible shape, people will be like, what's going on?
No, it's like, I can't be fat. I cannot be fat. So that's great. I'm not allowed to be fat. It's just,
sure.
I would never live it down. Now, you don't need to write books to have this type of social accountability. You can create a betting pool, for instance, for weight loss. So you could have 4 or 5 people put in $100 each, and the person who loses the most body fat, key, not just scale. So you can use DEXA scans for this, or any number of different tools, then wins the entire pool, right? And what's cool about that is you will actually work harder to not lose your $100 and to beat the other people than you will to earn the 500 or 600, whatever it might be, right? So that could be one example. Another would be using a site like coach.me or stick, STICKK.com. Diet Bet is another. I'm just going to rattle off a few. Another would be simply making generally subconscious responses more conscious. And so, for instance, I think something that is very helpful for both implementing stoic practices in a very kind of proactive operating system type sense, where it's a system for making better decisions, and in a way to address ego in quite a few different manifestations, is to do a no complaint experiment, where you have, say, and this is from Will Bauer, who's a reverend, I believe, or a preacher at the very least, has a large congregation, and he puts a rubber band effectively, or a bracelet, on one arm, and you're not allowed to complain for 21 days. And every time you complain, you snap it on your wrist, you put it on the other wrist, and the clock starts over. 21 days without complaining. And people can search 21-day no complaint experiment in my name if you want more on that. But the point being, I think that it's quite one thing to read about these things, which is very important. I think you need to have like the owner's manual, and to deductively or inductively, right, whether you're going from concepts to examples or examples to concepts, ingrain this and have a firm understanding of it. But then when the rubber hits the road, you have to actually condition yourself and practice this just like you would go running, just like you would meditate in the morning, use an app like Headspace, just like you would commit to scheduling anything else. You need to make this a practice, I think. And that's where a lot of people fail, is with any type of nonfiction or how-to, and I've certainly done this myself, is read the book, you're like, great, so happy I checked that off. And then you put it down, like 6 months later, you're like, oh yeah, that book, wow, I haven't done anything that was in that book. So what advice would you give to people who want to make the leap from the written page to real life? Any other thoughts?
Look, I think that's the tough part. How does knowledge become experience? There's a quote, I think I use it in the book, but it's from Plutarch. He was talking about, I forget what he's talking about, but basically he's saying it was not so much from the words that I got the knowledge, it was from my experience of the words. I'm butchering this quote, it's horrible. But basically he was saying it wasn't the words that helped me with my experiences, it was the experiences that I brought to the words that helped me understand them in a new way. And I think it's got to be this mix. Like, if you're not leaving a book or, something you've read, if you're not leaving it with okay, now I'm going to do X because of this, then you're just pursuing it for its own sake. I don't want to say it's masturbation, but it's close, right? Like, you're not achieving anything. You just spent a year reading a week reading a self-improvement book, but tell me what you're going to do with this information. And so that's what you've constantly got to do, whatever you're reading, whatever you're thinking is, okay, I'm now going to put this thing into practice. It doesn't have to be a huge thing. It can be the smallest possible thing. But if you don't leave with some sort of actionable thing, you're really just deluding yourself. And I think it's like, look, you can read a book about Brazilian jiu-jitsu. That doesn't make you any better at it. It's only if you try that out on the mat and against another human being that's going to lead to any sort of real improvement. It's got to become muscle memory. You know, with stoicism, it's if you're not applying these things in a small way in insignificant situations, what are the chances that you're going to be able to do it in an extremely adverse, stressful, overwhelming situation? It's very slim.
Slim to none. Yeah. So the Plutarch quote, I think this is it. "For it was not so much that by means of words I came to a complete understanding of things, as that from things I somehow had an experience which enabled me to follow the meaning of words." That is a tough one to remember.
Yeah.
But to your point, then this is one of my favorite quotes. I think it's Archilochus is how you would say it, but we do not rise to the level of our hopes. We fall to the levels of our training.
Yeah.
And so in my experience with training, let's just use the athletic example. You have planning, right? Or programming, right? You have planning, then you have practice, and then you have reflection or review. And that review piece is very important. So I want to underscore something you said about journaling. There's a book called The 5-Minute Journal, which you can use. I use pretty much every morning and every evening, 2.5 minutes in the morning, 2.5 minutes at night, to accomplish two things. All right. To have clarity on this kind of prep and review portion of the day, practice being the rest of the day in between. Also to cultivate the practice of gratitude and actually writing down three things that you're grateful for each day, including one that is very small, not anything necessarily all-encompassing like the health of my friends and family, right? That's fantastic, but you can very quickly go on autopilot and just list that off every day. And I've talked about this before in my morning routine, so I won't belabor it here, but the point being that when I've spent time with, say, Tony Robbins, for instance, who is one of the most, I think, effective, certainly impressive interventionists when it comes to personal crises that I've ever seen in my life. It's really it's just mind blowing what this guy can accomplish in a handful of minutes with someone he's never met before. And he has said before, and it really made sense when I started reflecting on this, that most of our suffering and misery comes from a focus on me.
Sure.
It's just a self focus. And I think that this gratitude helps to relieve that pressure and that compulsion somewhat. So that journaling, I think, is particularly important. Well, Ryan, I know we're probably coming up on time here. Is there anything that you would like to, leave people with? Anything for them to think about or to consider to take with them?
Yeah. I mean, I liked what you were just saying about Tony. I think that's really interesting. It's this idea that one, it's when you make something all about you, you stop seeing it rationally. And I think the other thing I found that was helpful for me is this idea of like, this thing, however many copies my book sells or however much money I make or whoever I know, if you could start to realize that none of these things say anything about you as a person, right? And I think that's why we get so caught up. It's like, we're like, the kind of car I drive says something about me as a person. The number of Twitter followers I have says something about me as a person. So then we're like so possessive and aggressive and ambitious and controlling about them because like we've wrapped our identity up in them. When I was first writing the book, the original title is based on a quote from Paul Graham where he says, keep your identity small. Because the smaller your identity, the more you're able to be flexible and adaptive and creative and, you know, see changes and disruption coming in the world. And so I think this idea of wrapping our identity up in our work or, you know, in material things that the Stoics would put in the category of what we don't control, that's where we start to get in serious trouble because now, you know, something can always threaten that thing. Someone can repossess your car, or, you know, someone can give you a negative review on your book. And now all of a sudden you're reacting super negatively and emotionally and angry. And that's when you do things that you're not proud of.
Hear, hear, right. Training yourself to value most the things that cannot be taken away.
And I think that's a scary idea for people, but it's ultimately very freeing, right? Because you're immune to the fluctuations of events. That doesn't mean that you can't live in a nice house and, you know, you can't have fun and you can't have things that you're trying to accomplish. But you want to, I think, cultivate that resilience that, like, hey, you know, if I had to start over tomorrow, I would still be me and I would have all the skills that I bring to the table and I'd be pretty good. That, to me, that's much better than, like, being Richard Nixon ranting on the White House tapes about all these people who are trying to screw him over, you know?
Yeah. And stay out of politics would be the corollary.
Yes.
But, unless you're perhaps a Sherman who in the first place doesn't want to be in politics, but would probably do the best job, the irony of the age in which we live. But Ryan, this is always a pleasure. I love being reminded always of the first principles in some ways of living the good life, whether that's choosing to use certain things as tools that make terrible masters, whether that's money, possessions, otherwise, and keeping in mind, in many ways, just the serenity prayer and the two very separate buckets of things that you can control and things you can't control, and then working methodically, dispassionately, very often, on the things that you can control. Because, I mean, these little actions cumulatively are the big actions. And I suppose on that note, I will thank you for taking the time. I really appreciate it.
Thank you for having me. It's always good.
And until next time, thank you for listening.
Audible hopes you have enjoyed this program.